Welcome. This is an interpreter roundtable. My name is Martin Tanner. I'll be moderating. Today we have on this roundtable panel Bruce Webster and Stephen Smoot. We today are covering Book of Mormon Gospel Doctrine Lesson 32, the title of which is They Did Obey Every Word of Command with Exactness. The purpose of this lesson, according to the manual, is to help members see that the Lord will strengthen them as they follow the example of Helaman's valiant young soldiers, meaning the stripling warriors. This is great material. It starts and gives us verses 10 through 19 in chapter 53 of Alma, and then goes straight through from Alma 56 through the end of chapter 58 to give us some background material on the context, which is always nice if you understand the context of a lesson. Let's start off with Bruce.
This is the second of two lessons on the war chapters of the Book of Mormon. And if you've been paying attention in your reading and in the lesson, what you'll see is this is really a very complex, almost multipolar war. It's a civil war, really, among various Nephite factions. Nephite dissenters have taken over the Lamanites and are using them, basically stirring them up through propaganda to attack the Nephites. And the war isn't going terribly well, necessarily. It's dragging on. It's taking time. It's giving costs. And as we see, particularly in verses 8 and 9, before we get to the opening citation from the lesson, says that, now it came to pass that the armies of the Lamanites on the west sea south, while in the absence of Moroni and the kind of some intrigue, had gained some ground, yada, and thus because of iniquity amongst themselves, meaning amongst the Nephites, yea, because of dissensions and intrigue among themselves, they're placed in those dangerous circumstances. Now we get to this interesting development. We had in a previous lesson a discussion of the anti-Nephi Lehis, who eventually had to leave Lamanite territory for their own safety, took up residence originally in the land of Jershon, and were protected in exchange for providing goods to the Nephite armies that protected them. And where we're at now here is that the Ammonites, people of Ammon, the formerly anti-Nephi Lehis, are considering breaking their oath to never take up lessons. They see the Straits as being that difficult. They're feeling very bad at, you know, watching the Nephites die by the thousands for protecting them. And Helaman steps in and basically says, you know, no, don't do this. This is a serious oath you've taken. He fears that they should lose their souls by doing it. But, and this is the thrust of the lessons, they had sons who had never taken these oaths, these young warriors. And they said, well, we'll do this and let them take over, but in an interesting twist. Now keep in mind, Helaman is a religious leader at this point. He's the son of Alma. He's been running the church since Alma's disappearance. And the Ammonite stripling warriors say, we want Helaman to lead us. I'm not sure how Helaman necessarily felt about that at that first instance. So with that lead-in for the setting here we are in the wars, and we have the rise of this group of stripling warriors. I'll throw it back to Martin and Stephen for comments and observations.
I wanted to toss out a question to both of you, and if you choose to comment or not, that's fine. But what is your take on why there are so many wars detailed in the Book of Mormon? What purpose does that serve?
Well, if I could comment to that for just a moment. I think we have to understand that, as is true today, largely, warfare in the ancient world took on not just sort of nationalistic significance, but even cosmic and mythological significance. Warfare in the ancient world was seen in large part to be warfare against competing deities. So it wasn't just that your nations are going to war, your nation's gods are going to war against other nations and other gods. And the victory or defeat in war was interpreted often to be to have religious or mythological or cosmic significance. And so this is, I think, pretty clear in the Book of Mormon, where Mormon is always wrapping things up in Nephite righteousness, Nephite devotion to God, Nephite preservation of the gospel. When they're faithful to God, they prosper. When they're unfaithful, they get defeated, et cetera, et cetera. This is how Mormon casts this. So, you can look at the political and the nationalistic significance that war played for the Nephites and Lamanites, but I think, as is true for their other ancient contemporaries, it took on a cosmic and a mythic significance for them as well. This was the Lord fighting for them, preserving them from their enemies, preserving the gospel, preserving their way of life, and so it takes on that significance as well.
And I'll just underscore what Stephen said. I think the Book of Mormon makes that very clear, because you have this running theme that as long as the Nephites are righteous, they have this special strength in fighting the Lamanites. And in times where you have lack of righteousness, pervasiveness among the Nephites, you talk about them becoming weak as ordinary men. So there was very much this mythic quality. And in a lot of the communications we see between opposing leaders, there are religious issues that are brought forth. It's, you know, the foolish traditions of your fathers, and, you know, we know this, and you don't really know that. And I think that's a very important point that Stephen has made. I actually, my freshman year at BYU, I had an Honors Book of Mormon class with Chauncey Riddle, who was dean of the graduate school. And one of the things he had us do was write a paper on why did Mormon spend 20 chapters on war in the Book of Alma? And in terms of time frame, the time period covered is relatively short compared to the history of the Book of Mormon. We're talking, I haven't done the calculation, but I suspect we're talking about 15 years worth of war, maybe 20. The whole Book of Alma covers under 40 years. And the wars start about halfway through chronologically. So it's a little over 20 years of war. But this is such a pattern. I think Mormon was drawing upon his own experience in seeing the decline and fall of what he felt was civilization among the Nephites in his own time. That during the period in which he did a lot of the drafting of the Book of Mormon, which I suspect a lot of that happened during the 10 years when he stepped down as military commander for the Nephites, I think he had some very specific teaching purposes in mind. And one of them was that unrighteousness leads to destruction. And that's a message, as the pioneer, as Nibley pointed out time and again, the Nephites tend to end up in wars when they're unrighteous. It isn't often that the Nephites are living righteously and, you know, the church is strong and everyone is doing well, and they're actually in a period of warfare. It is usually, as Mormon says, or Alma says, and Mormon quotes in verse 9 of this chapter 53, because of iniquity amongst themselves, because of dissensions and intrigues amongst themselves, they were placed in the most dangerous of circumstances. I think that's what Mormon saw in his own time, and I think he was showing that this is a universal truth. This wasn't something particular to his time and circumstance, but it's something that is true across time and is meant as a warning for our day.
Well said.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring up, how Mormon is going to cast and portray these wars and the significance he's going to attach to these wars. And one of the sort of the hallmarks of ancient historiography, of ancient historians. Think of Herodotus or Thucydides or think of Julius Caesar writing about the Gallic Wars and so forth. One of the things they do is they absolutely infuse these sort of moral lessons that they want to get across here. Modern history, right, the ideal is to just sort of objectively report the facts of what happened and to avoid moralizing, avoid ascribing motives, and avoid trying to create, you know, sort of moral or religious or cosmic significance out of these wars. For the most part, that's the paradigm modernly. But the ancients did not share that perspective. They did not share that paradigm. And so the fact that Mormon just wraps all of this up with, as you're saying, Bruce, spiritual and moral lessons, he's seeing stuff happening in his own time, and he wants to reflect on how that's significant for him, how it's going to be significant for his readers, et cetera, et cetera. And this gives us a clear indication why I think he's including more chapters at all. He's doing history, but it's not the modern sense of history that we think of today. It's more of sort of a narrative history where he's trying to lead his readers into specific moral conclusions and theological conclusions based on how he's reporting these wars. This isn't to say that he's necessarily just sort of making stuff up, but rather to say the way he's narrating and fashioning and portraying these wars, it's really clear that there's something else going on here beyond just sort of surface level reporting of what happened.
Well, think of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, where he's taking the aftermath of a major battle and a very difficult battle and turning it to a lesson for the country, both a call to duty, not even a call to arms. You know, Lincoln doesn't get up at Gettysburg and say, we need to go slaughter these people in the South. He sets a very moral tone to the nature of the conflict and a very lofty goal for what it is they're striving for. And you don't hear it as much any day, but World War II, I mean, as a boomer who grew up in the 50s and 60s, World War II was seen as the good war. It was seen as you know, morally uncomplicated from a war perspective. We were defending against Germany, we were defending against Japan, both were the aggressors, and we did so without, you know, conquesting and then keeping hold of those territories and so on. And in a way, it has laid a foundation, from a historical point of view, I think World War II was essential with American involvement, and I think we did a great good for the world. But I fear that it left us with for a period of some time, a lack of understanding of how awful war can be and what the moral costs and consequences of war are. And we saw those subsequently in Vietnam. We've seen it, both Iraq and Afghanistan, in terms of U.S. casualties, have been relatively minor compared to, say, World War II. My father was in single battles or single events that cost more American lives than the entire Iraq War, such as the invasion of Guam. But that said, I think Mormon is trying to get across two important points. First, wars come due to unrighteousness and dissension, and they have tremendous cost. And what's very interesting is Mormon is very clear about this, both in the wars in the Book of Alma and especially the wars in his own time. About he talks later in Alma, and I think it may be in one of our passages, it may not be in something we cover, about the hearts that were hardened. Basically the emotional, the spiritual and the physical costs of war, even though it was a war, it was a defensive war, a war to preserve themselves, there were still tremendous costs, and it wasn't that everyone was, you know, marching lockstep arm in arm and whistling as they came home.
True. A couple of quick comments, and then let's dive straight into the verses. To back up one of the first, if you take, and I won't get this exactly right, but this will be a close paraphrase, in Deuteronomy chapter 32, in verses 8 and 9, you have this statement in the Bible which says, when the Most High God divided up the nations by implication among his sons, for Jehovah's portion, he gave him the children of Israel, implying that the other nations had some other deity assigned to them. And so the idea that every nation had its own deity, or every group, the idea that Stephen was mentioning is right there in the Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 32. I've thought about this idea of why we have so much about wars in the Book of Mormon, and there are many ways to approach this, but war has been a way of life throughout history. We live in one of the only time periods where the general population hasn't been so dramatically impacted. And so the idea of wars and spirituality and wars for good or for evil as being wars between right and wrong, good and evil, like you see in the Dead Sea Scrolls with the ultimate battle of the sons of light with the sons of darkness, are things that have been portrayed throughout history. And so the Book of Mormon's portrayal is sort of mirrored in the Dead Sea Scrolls and many other places. With that said, Alma chapter 53, our first few verses here, 10 through 19, sort of give us the backdrop and about the agreement of these stripling warriors or the young sons agreeing to fight. And the only point I wanted to make here is that the whole idea of Helaman fearing lest they would lose their souls shows to me that he is very much an ultra straight arrow kind of a guy here, because God justifies killing and death when it's justified, and so does the entire Judeo-Christian kind of legal landscape, if you will. Self-defense, defense of others have always been justified under the law. If somebody's going to kill you, you can use appropriate force to respond back. That's true in war and outside of war. And so we also saw, even in other contexts, Nephi being justified in killing Laban, even though there is a general prescription, thou shalt not kill. In that kind of a context, it was okay. And so it might have been legally appropriate for them to say, under this kind of a circumstance where our entire group, our entire culture is at risk, we are justified in taking up our arms, notwithstanding the oath that we made before. And yet Helaman looks at the point behind that and finds a different way. And there's something to be said for that, because that's the message that's brought here. And the message seems to be that whenever you can find a way to meet the letter of the law, not just the spirit, you ought to do so. And that's a great message, because you will never be wrong if you can meet the letter of the law, even if you think you might be justified in not doing because of exigent circumstances. So I love the way this is set up. It's a fascinating story, and it's one of great courage and great faith. Anything else on chapter 53? Okay, I hope I haven't said too much here. Let's jump to chapter 56. 56 gives the background here about the epistles from Helaman to Moroni, recounting what actually happened. Because back then, no tape recorders, no cameras were rolling. You wait till the end to hear exactly what happens. And this is the recounting of the war that ensued, the battles that ensued, with these 2,000 young men Anybody want to jump in here and talk about chapter 56?
Well, I'll just say a couple of things, sort of generally about the stripling warriors. We have this fun image in our minds about the stripling warriors, thanks to our dear friend Arnold Freeberg, who gave us those wonderful paintings. And as every Mormon who grew up in primary knows, the stripling warriors are these ultra-buff bodybuilders, right, who are being led by Helaman, who's of course riding a horse with his Roman breastplate and armor and, you know, headgear and stuff. And these guys look like they've been jacked on steroids and they've been at the gym all day. Well, I think it's worth pointing out that the word stripling simply means adolescent. It probably puts them somewhere in their teens. Certainly no older than maybe 20, but probably more around 13 or 14, something like that. So when you imagine Helaman's stripling warriors, his stripling sons, think of deacons in your ward. Think of the teachers or the priests, right? Think of the Aaronic priesthood in your ward. And that's what we're talking about here. And I think it's significant that these are the guys who go up against some of the elite Lamanite forces, right? And they willingly do it because they have this much faith and confidence. And I think it's also significant to know their age, not only to appreciate their courage, but to appreciate the miracle that occurs when they are preserved and they have no casualties. Imagine your teacher's quorum going off to war and all of them, you know, against the German SS during World War II and all of them coming back home without any of them dying. That would be a miracle by any stretch of, you know, the imagination. So I think the point that they're trying to underscore here, because they consistently say, my young sons, these young men, these sons, right? Like it's this consistent language of them being youths or young. I think what they're trying to underscore here, what Helaman and Mormon in his redaction is trying to underscore here is how miraculous this is, that these young kids, these punks basically, are able to take on elite Lamanite forces and they all survive. So I think that helps us appreciate more as we read these chapters, the miracle behind it, and it helps us give us an idea of also sort of Nephite culture behind what's going on here to understand their age and who they are.
I'll take slight issue with Stephen. It's about 13 years from the time that the anti-Nephi Lehis leave and move into the Zarahemla area until this time. And the stripling warriors are specifically mentioned as being too young to have taken the oath. So there are probably several who, you know, a lot of them are probably in their mid to later teens, but I fully agree it's probably not much older than that.
Yeah.
And it's also useful. I served my mission in Central America, which makes the Arnold Freeberg paintings all the more funny. You have to realize these are all small people down here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you look at the native Indian populations, I would strongly recommend for anyone who really wants to get a sense of what a lot of this was like, go to YouTube and look up some of the clips from Mel Gibson's movie Apocalypto, which was filmed using actual Mayans down in Central America. And you will see how thin and wiry, not weak. These are, you know, these are people who can run for days and so on. But it's a very different image of battle than the image we have with the classic Book of Mormon paintings and so on. Once you hit, I dare say, and again, we have to realize we tend to be, teenagehood is a relatively modern invention.
Yeah, within the last 100 years at least.
Yeah. Adulthood really happened pretty much right, you know, when either sex went through puberty, that was the start of adulthood. So these were young stripling warriors. I think the stripling may apply to the fact that, to a certain extent, that they hadn't had some of the training, but they were probably not that much smaller than the adults they were fighting against. They were just younger and skinnier and less experienced, which emphasizes a miraculous nature. I think your example is perfect. It's take a bunch of youth, take a bunch of young men quorums and send them out to World War II and have them come back All Alive is a wonderful example. In 26, we get, and I know the lesson is actually short and is emphasizing primarily the miraculous nature of the faith. But I read a lot of military history. I don't have my books out here. They're in boxes downstairs right now. But I probably have two or three shelves worth of military history books. And what my impression going through these sections of the Book of Mormon and others who are far more experienced than I have pointed that out as well, is that the military aspects ring true. Nibley pointed this out as well, and Nibley knew it quite well. I mean, he went ashore at Normandy. And I find it intriguing that he says, as he was going ashore at Normandy at D-Day, the thought that kept going through his mind was, the Book of Mormon is really a remarkable book. But the part of, for me, the authenticity of the Book of Mormon is just how chaotic these battles are, how things can turn. Mormon, you know, does have teaching moments he wants to make, but some of the teaching moments are, yeah, sometimes things go bad. You talk about the great relief that the troops feel when Helaman shows up with the stripling warriors because they've had lack of supplies, they've had, losses and so on. And even with the stripling warriors, part of the reason Helaman is writing this letter, this detailed letter to Moroni, is to request help. He says, we're starving. We're losing. Why are we getting the assistance we need from the center country? What's going on here? And so this is the context of the what an impact these stripling warriors had on the entire Nephite War. And that groundwork was ultimately laid by the Sons of Mosiah going and preaching among Lamanites. That turned out to be the military salvation of the Nephites, both because it drew a large number of Lamanites away from Lamanite territory into Nephite territory and then gave back these stripling warriors who we'll see make the difference time and again in some of these key battles.
Quick comment. And I enjoyed Stephen's comments about the lack of accuracy of Arnold Freeberg's paintings. And I wanted to point out, which were entirely appropriate, I wanted to mention a couple of things about what that really demonstrates. I knew Arnold Freeberg, was introduced to him, and saw him at least once or twice a year at parties for about the last 20 years of his life. And I went to his house several times and saw virtually every painting he did, because he was sort of a painting pack rat and he never sold any of them. He just pretty much kept everything he ever did. And he was a meticulous scholar and an incredible artist. And the way he made everybody look buff was that he made their heads slightly smaller than they really would be in proportion to a person's body. So that's how he got that immense strength with them. And he wanted them to look strong for a purpose. But when you look at the outfits they have and the way they probably looked as youth, it just doesn't work. And the main point that I wanted to make here is that Stephen's right. With current scholarship and our knowledge of the way everything happened at that point in time, it's just all wrong. It's just all wrong.
Yeah.
But Freeberg did the best he could with the information he had at the time, and that shows how far Book of Mormon scholarship has come, frankly. When Joseph Smith, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't want to, make out Arnold Freeberg be some kind of an idiot or something, right? I'm not trying to, disparage his artwork, because it's wonderful artwork. We all grew up with it, and it has these images in our minds. It's just the point is, As any historian on planet Earth will tell you, do not take the artwork seriously when you encounter it. It's really nice. It inspires nice feelings. It can be very beautiful. It can be very inspiring. But please do not take it as some sort of statement on historical reality. Appreciate it for what it is and just sort of, you know, move on from there.
And that's exactly right. When Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon, he had virtually no information about what things would have been like in the Lehi, Nephi, you know, Lamanite, Nephi location, and for now I'll just leave the issue of where all that happened alone, but I think it was Mesoamerica, but hey, that argument for another time. But the point is that Freeburg didn't have much more information than Joseph Smith did, and Joseph Smith had none, and people who have done research on it now know that these paintings are just not accurate. Anyway, I'm beating a dead horse, but let's move on. Other comments about Alma 56?
Well, of course, we have the famous passage there starting in 46. Well, really, 43. where Helaman is using the stripling warriors as bait to lure the Nephites away, or Lamanites away. And they're tired from this long march, and the army of Antipas overtakes Lamanites from the rear, and Helaman basically says, you know, okay, guys, sons, what should we do? Are you willing to go to fight against him? And verses 45 and 46 are the verses we hear, actually 46 through 48 are the verses that we so often hear, where he talks about the courage of the stripling warriors. And they say, quite frankly, we trust in God. He won't let us fall. We wouldn't kill our brethren if they would leave us alone. And he makes a point that these are not experienced warriors. He says, now they never had fought, yet they did not fear death, and they did think more upon the liberty of their fathers than they did upon their lives. Yea, they had been taught by their mothers that if they did not doubt, God would deliver them. And they rehearsed unto me the words of their mother, saying, we do not doubt. Our mothers knew it. Now, of course, these are the passages that warm the heart of every mother who's sending her son, or for that matter, daughter, out on a mission. In fact, my wife still talks about our oldest son's missionary farewell, and we had many, many struggles with him as he was growing up. He ended up going on a mission later than usual because of those struggles and so on, but he happened to give his missionary farewell talk on Mother's Day. And she said that was the first time at that point in her life she'd enjoyed a Mother's Day sacrament meeting. but the other thing was just... she suddenly saw a payoff for all those years of struggles and so on. I think some LDS mothers struggle at times thinking, you know, am I doing a good enough time? Do my children have the faith they should have because I've taught them and so on? But I think part of the message here is that we don't always know and understand the depths of the impact that we have upon our children. And in some cases we may never know that. This is as powerful a lesson as we find in all the scriptures of teaching our children faith in God and teaching them right from wrong, and the necessity of that, and the unforeseen consequences, benefits of that.
great comments. I have just one final comment on chapter 56, and that is that faith was exercised by them, and not one of them had fallen to the earth, it says in verse 56. But faith is good whether or not it has the hoped for result. Many people throughout history have had great faith and have died. Many people have had great faith and have had a relative die, or have had some other great blessing that they had hoped for that has not come to fruition. But in the long term, the faith that is described here will be rewarded. And so if you who are watching this have had some great tragedy in your life that did not result, obviously, in the way you had hoped for or prayed for, don't lose faith and don't for a minute believe that somehow you are not worthy or that the message of the stripling warriors does not apply to you for some reason, because it does. Sometimes the blessings come immediately and sometimes they come down the road, but I believe with all my heart that they do come, and they come because of the kind of faith that is described here. Any other comments on chapter 56? Let's move on to chapter 57 then. This is another fascinating chapter. It deals with the wars. It talks about the surrender, defense, and it continues to recount the descriptions. My favorite verse in chapter 57 here, to try to be brief in the interest of time here, is that, and it came to pass that there were 200 out of my 2,060 who had fainted because of the loss of blood, which indicates that it's not that they all just miraculously came out completely unscathed. They had fainted because of loss of blood. And nevertheless, according to the goodness of God and to our great astonishment and also the joy of our whole army, there was not one soul of them who did perish. Except, keep in mind here that it also says not, let's see, here it is. Neither was there one soul among them who had not received many wounds. So this was not a situation where they were unscathed, where they went through battle without injury. Everyone was injured, or was injured, some of them very seriously, fainting from loss of blood, and yet they all ultimately survived. So they did so at great, great personal sacrifice. Other comments on chapter 57?
I've got one. 8 years ago, when we were going through Book of Mormon and Gospel Doctrine, in fact, I was teaching it back in Colorado, and my wife and I were doing our usual nightly readings of chapters, and I happened to be, at the same time my wife and I were going through the war chapters in Alma, I happened to be reading Arian's The Campaigns of Alexander, that is, Alexander the Great. And I was absolutely struck by the parallels between the two. In fact, I wrote a tongue-in-cheek blog post called New Light on Book of Mormon Origins, claiming that Joseph Smith had somehow gotten a hold of a copy of Arian's Campaigns of Alexander and had used this, because and I actually produced a list of about 25 similarities that were found in both of them. you know, both volumes describe the murder of a civilization's ruler by Usurper, who assumes his kingship, as well as other plots to overthrow and kill a ruler. Both volumes deal with religious issues and themes, including signs, some of which are astronomical, and prophecies, some of which are fulfilled. Both volumes describe the chief capital city discussed in the volume as being destroyed by fire, so on and so forth. But a lot of the military things, you know, describe intricate army maneuvers, including forced marches, night marches, ambushes, dividing up of forces, attacks from multiple sides, brief and extended sieges, and so on. And what struck me is how much warfare in the Book of Mormon echoes ancient warfare versus any warfare that Joseph Smith might have been exposed to, which really would have been, frankly, the revolutionary, you know, talking to veterans of the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. That's probably it. Maybe some of the European conflicts with information, but you don't see those echoes, those same echoes, the same way you see and Stephen, I'm sure, can talk at length about the parallels between what you see in the Book of Mormon and ancient Near Eastern practices of warfare. It was very fascinating to me to realize how much at home the warfare and the events, the civil events surrounding the warfare, echoed things that were actually chronicled in the campaigns of Alexander the Great through Persia and over into India and back.
Yeah, I there's no question in my mind that the warfare depicted in the Book of Mormon is it's authentic and it's realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, this is people who actually, this is coming from a person who experienced war and who had sources, direct access to sources that experienced war. Anybody who, and you could take it from me because I've tried my hand in writing fiction fantasy that involves warfare, and I've never been involved in warfare, so, you know, I'm getting my stuff from secondary, tertiary sources and kind of imagining what it's like. But the most compelling stories, both fiction and nonfiction, come from those who have experienced war firsthand. I can think of Tolkien in Lord of the Rings, right? His experiences in World War I directly contributed to his depiction of warfare in the Lord of the Rings because he had experienced it. So yeah. I'm convinced that whoever penned these chapters, they had firsthand experience with war, and I would also say they had a firsthand experience with ancient war, from everything to methods to tactics to the ideology of warfare. Just to read what you were saying, Bruce, there's no question in my mind that these are realistic and authentic portrayals of ancient warfare. And there's been a lot published on this.
Yeah.
There's an old volume in Farms on warfare in the Book of Mormon.
Which needs to be reprinted.
It needs to be reprinted, but even in the last couple of years, there have been a number of independent scholars who have written stuff. So my little plug for Book of Mormon Central, you can go on there and you can check out our archive and our Knowwise, and we have some stuff on this. And you can see military historians and people who have fought in war themselves who are taking a look at Book of Mormon war chapters and saying, this is absolutely realistic.
Yeah.
Great comments. Excellent comments. And one of the things that that you can find on Stephen's website is a description, or some great articles that describe the actual weapons of war. You know, for Joseph Smith, his contact with Native Americans would have been people who rode on horses, or not necessarily, but that would have been a portrayal that he knew of. And they would have used bows and arrows and a few other things, tomahawks. And the Book of Mormon, you see some things like that, but you see spears, scimitars, you see head plates. You know, when was the last time you saw a John Wayne movie and the Indians were riding up with head plates, whatever that is, a helmet? I don't know. It's just, these are things that Joseph Smith describes, which are found in the Book of Mormon, and he would have had no way to garner any knowledge about that. But now we know that those kinds of battle accoutrements are exactly what Mesoamerican warriors would have worn. Hey, go to Stephen's website. There's some great stuff there.
Yeah. I'll put in a plug for Morgan Dean, D-E-A-N-E as well, who's got his Warfare in the Book of Mormon, has published, I think, 2 books now, analyzing a Warfare in the Book of Mormon, and certainly a number of articles. So it is telling authenticity, because there's no way Joseph would have been familiar with this stuff. I mean, we're back to the strain at a gnat and swallow a camel school of a Book of Mormon criticism, where people say, well, what about this? And, you know, we're not sure this would have been the vocalization of Nahum in, you know, in southwestern Arabia. Whereas it's like, okay, explain to me, let's go to First Principles. Explain to me how Joseph Smith understood ancient warfare so well. What were his sources? How could he write so convincingly and so authentic about warfare, period, and specifically ancient warfare and its practices? Where was his basis? And I'll echo what Stephen says. I too have tried my hand at some novels, none of which I finished, but frankly, trying to write fiction has been very telling for me in recognizing what a miracle the Book of Mormon is. Because the simple fact, I have one novel where I have a spreadsheet to try and keep track of all the characters and the years and how old they are at each point, and so on. And yet you have this tremendously complex narrative in the Book of Mormon, which is consistent.
And
that's staggering to me. That is absolutely staggering to me. How complex, how the narrative is both complex and the geography is complex, but it's also consistent.
Yeah, there's only one instance in the Alma War chapters where Mormon gets the name of a city wrong. When he's talking about the geography of the different battles and the troop movements and so forth, and every chapter they're moving to different cities, they're taking different cities, they're traveling between different states and different lands and so forth, and there's only one instance where there's a gaffe. Pardon the pun, but try pulling that out of your hat if you're Joseph Smith, right?
Yeah.
And being able to come up with that.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other comments on chapter 57? We've got about 10 minutes to hit chapter 58 here. Chapter 58, then. This is our wrap-up to our lesson, chapter 58, and it continues on with the wars that are going on here, the battles, and there are some great tactics here that Joseph Smith would not have been aware of in chapters 17, 18, and 19. It talks about sort of a trick retreat, not trick or treat, but a retreat that's sort of a faux or pretend retreat to lure the Lamanites in, and of course it works, and this is a wonderful battle tactic that's mentioned here. But to really wrap up the message here, from my perspective, it's sort of summed up in the last few verses, where Moroni is described by Helaman, well, rather than paraphrase it, verse 41, "And now, my beloved brother Moroni, may the Lord our God, who has redeemed us and made us free, keep you continually in his presence. Yea, and may he favor this people, even that ye may have success in obtaining the possession of all that which the Lamanites have taken from us, which was for our support, and now behold, I close mine epistle. I am Helaman, the son of Alma." So he's writing to Moroni, and here he concludes. And his parting words are, let you be continually in the presence of God, and let justice be done. may God give us our stuff back that has been taken by the Lamanites. And beautiful statements of faith here by Helaman as he closes his epistle. He's just gone through and described all these miraculous events, all the difficulties, all the trials, and at the very end, he again references God as the one behind all of these difficult yet worthy endeavors which have resulted in a good outcome, in a wonderful outcome. I love these verses. I love these chapters. This is a great, great message. To you, to anyone else who would like to comment.
The lesson here ends with Alma 58, and the next lesson picks up with Helaman 1. So it skips the last several chapters of Alma, which are worth taking the time to read. One of the things that you note right off the bat is that after the end of the war, which actually wraps up pretty quickly, basically there's about one more year of warfare that involves a literal civil war, or at least civil upheaval amongst the Nephites, and then once that's taken care of, they are finally able to drive the Lamanites out of the land. And one other thing that is smacks of authenticity, both Helaman and Moroni die at a relatively young age, and die shortly after the war's end. Neither one of them, Alma the Elder lived to 80-something, I believe. I think we have that established as his age and his death. Helaman and Moroni both are dead in their, well, Moroni we know, Moroni. We know it's in his 30s. Helaman dies in the 36th year of the reign of the judges. He was son of Alma, so he may have been older, he may have been in his 40s, up to maybe 50-ish, but it's clear that the war took a tremendous toll on both of them. They both died quickly, and actually Helaman turns over the records to Shiblon, who will also die within a few years of his father. There's been, and you get the sense of the tremendous cost that there's been to the Zarahemla basin of this war, the number of males who've been killed, the destruction that's come through the various invasions and so on. And you have, I think that the society itself has suffered a blow as a result of this. And what we're going to see in the next lesson that starts with Helaman 1 is through the course of the book of Helaman and then on into the first several chapters of 3 Nephi, a fracturing and ultimately breaking apart of the Nephite government or culture, if you will. So war has its costs. I mean, that's one of the most important lessons that I think Mormon is making through the war chapters. They're very real social and civil costs to war.
Parting comments from you, Stephen?
Nothing from me. You both said that very well.
You're kind to say that. We'll wrap up our roundtable then. This has been Lesson 32 of the Book of Mormon, the title of which is They Did Obey Every Word of Command with Exactness, covering Alma chapters 53, the first verses 10 through 19, and then chapters 56 through 58. My name is Martin Tanner. I've been moderating. And tonight we've also had Bruce Webster and Stephen Smoot with wonderful contributions. We hope you'll join us again for more roundtables in the future, and also check out More of Interest on the Interpreter webpage, because there's some wonderful other things there as well.